a most serious problem for our society. Victims of abuse have been shown to have shorter life expectancy than non-abused older people. And elder abuse leads to premature dependence on a long-term care system, particularly the public-funded system. The Commission believes that in the cases where a frail elderly victim's memory may be failing, or the victim is becoming mentally incapacitated, it's both fair and desirable to be able to have a third party testify as to what a victim said immediately after the crime was performed. So the Governor's Commission on Senior Services supports the passage of Senate Bill 780. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Brand. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, Mr. Knapp.
If I may continue on that same subject, I prosecuted child abuse cases for 14 years, and I thought I would never see a victim more vulnerable than a child, as you can imagine. But what I've learned is that's not true. The victims that we're seeing in elder abuse cases are much more fragile than children. Children are resilient. They'll bounce back. They usually do. Elders don't bounce back. I've seen that almost every case I've prosecuted, I've seen a decline in the elder person's health to the point where sometimes, like I said, they're not able to come in court to testify. And people don't realize that. I didn't realize that until I started doing elder abuse cases, and I want you to know that because as soon as they become victims and they're aware of their victimization, their health declines mentally and physically. And that's why this bill is incredibly important, because if they can't make it to trial, at least someone who they told early on when they were still competent or didn't suffer from dementia or whatever can come into court and help support them and testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Are there questions?
Could I ask?
Representative Wall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this would be an excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule that would cover the elderly, or if they are not available for testimony, either because of mental incompetence or death.
It's not exactly the excited utterance exception. That's still in place.
Mm-hmm.
But there are lots of statements that don't qualify under the excited utterance exception. The excited utterance exception is based on the fact that the statement was made close in time to the incident, and the person was still under the stress of the incident. This is not necessarily the case.
It doesn't require stress.
Well, no, it doesn't require stress, and it doesn't really necessarily require it be made close in time either to the time of the incident. For instance, I have a case that the woman that's pending right now that involves $228,000, and this occurred over a period of about a year and a half. Now, at one point, after she paid, about a week or two after the last payment she made to the offender, she then told the neighbor. And it wasn't necessarily close in time to all of the financial exploitation. And it certainly, I mean, she wasn't necessarily under the excitement of the loss of the money, but I'm sure that was still with her. But the fact that she made this statement concerning the giving of the money to this suspect, and it relates to the theft to the crime. Now, if she's not able to testify in court, if we can establish that the statement was reliable, if we can establish that it's corroborated, and we give our notice that's required by the statute 15 days before trial, then, those statements that the victim made to her neighbor would come on in.
Awesome.
Follow up.
So that statement might be admissible even if she had made it while she was mentally incompetent?
Well, the statement, the court would have to look to determine what her state of mind was when she made it. And if the court found that it was reliable and corroborated, then it wouldn't be that she was incompetent at all. It would be admissible. If the court found that the statement wasn't reliable or wasn't corroborated, let's say, for instance, she was incompetent even back then, that statement would not be admissible.
Okay. Just wanted to understand.
Thank you.
Representative Sherrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand that the statute establishes equivalency here, all things being equal, between, on the one hand, witnesses who are chronologically or mentally under the age of 12 and those who are 65 years of age or older?
I would have to agree with that.
How do you feel about that, Representative Ackerman?
Well, I don't know if we're tracking the same thing, but I'm worried about
language.
Yeah. You know, I think inherent with my thoughts here are, how do you establish the reliability? How do you establish that these things are corroborated? I don't see that these are foundation types of things which must be established before this testimony would be admitted. And as one witness indicated, some of these witnesses are mentally incapacitated when they're making the statement, or their memories have failed. I'm worried about the addition of reliability prior to the admission of these out-of-court statements.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, unfortunately, I don't think that you have before you the complete text of 803-18-AAB. But within the statutory makeup of 803-18-AAB, the statute provides that the statement has to be reliable, and it sets out how to determine reliability. It also talks about corroboration and how the statement has to be corroborated. So the judge, for instance, in a pretrial hearing or outside the presence of jury, would go through all this, and for instance, the state would have to call witnesses, potentially the person themselves, or the doctor, or a caregiver, and we'd have to jump through these statutory hurdles, before the judge would allow this into evidence. And that's how the defendant's confrontation clause, that's how his confrontation clause issues are protected, because the court has to make those findings. Now, for those victims who are 65 years of age and older and who are in great health and have no mental problems, they will be witnesses in court. So they will be subject to cross-examination. So the fact that they're testifying and their statements they made to third parties would come in isn't a problem either, because, again, the witness themselves is there in the courtroom to be cross-examined. So that's not really a problem either. So either way, the suspect's rights are protected. Plus, if you have a victim who is 65 years of age or older who isn't going to be a good witness or isn't a competent witness, then this allows those cases to be successfully prosecuted. And, you know, some children 12 years of age and younger, I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years old who are outstanding witnesses. And I've had witnesses who are 5 and 8 years older who weren't even competent. And the same thing applies for people 65 years and age and older. We hope that our elder population gets old and is healthy and is competent. But we know at some point in time, everybody's health begins to fail. And unfortunately, in elder abuse cases, here's the glitch. The people who become victims in elder abuse cases already have some vulnerability. And that's what makes them victims. That's what makes them susceptible to elder abuse. They're already frail, or they're already mentally diminishing. They are maybe already suffering from some dementia. They may have very lucid moments most of the day, but they're vulnerable to a stranger, or maybe they're vulnerable to a family member or a relative that they're close to. But that's most of your cases starts it. And so this is why this statute protects those folks.
Any further discussion? Okay, thank you very much. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 780. That completes our agenda for today. We won't be working any of these bills today. The committee is adjourned.